force?
Sure. I don't know what else I could really add to his ex-wife's statements. They did have an acrimonious divorce. She did say to me that his demeanor really changed when he did become a Border Patrol agent, and they drifted apart for reasons, unknown. In terms of the most recent article you mentioned, I did do, I worked on a story really looking at, beginning in L.A. and certainly in Chicago and now Minneapolis, we see a rampant use of these, so-called less lethals, pepper balls and rubber bullets and pepper spray and that sort of thing. And their use has really been blatantly, flagrantly in violation of the agency's own rules and policing norms. For instance, firing at people's heads and crotches, throwing tear gas into cars where there are children, using these launchers in ways that, they're meant to deploy a weapon into a crowd, but they're hitting people and causing serious injury. And that story actually is relevant in what we saw with Alex Preti's death. That scene really escalates when a Border Patrol officer fires pepper spray at his face, causing disorientation, and several officers pile on. It'd be hard to imagine anyone in that scene really had their bearings of what's going on as those noxious chemicals are floating around.
J. David McSwain, I want to thank you for being with us, investigative reporter at ProPublica. We will link to your new piece, The Two CBP Agents Identified in Alex Preti Shooting, and your previous pieces, including Trump's immigration forces deploy so-called less lethal weapons in dangerous ways, skirting rules and maiming protesters. To come to our February 23rd, 30th anniversary event, go to democracynow.org.
KBOO Portland.
Every Tuesday night, Cubby Cushy Cubby Cush blasts forth from the KBOO studios. 2 hours of global bass centering South Asia and the South Asian diaspora, with an even tighter focus on Punjab and the Punjabi diaspora. Hosted by the incredible Kid, Tuesdays 10 to midnight on your community radio station. Let's go!
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Jay Hocken Productions, presenting a screening of Sumud, a doctor's report on genocide and survival in Gaza, at Cinema 21 on Sunday, February 8th. The screening will be followed by a panel discussion. Tickets and info at cinema21.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland Housing Bureau has an extra $15 million in unspent funds. The Oregon couple shot by Border Patrol in January did not have gang affiliation. And a federal court hears a case tomorrow that could block warrantless ICE arrests. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 3rd, 2026. I'm Eric Leuschner. The Portland Housing Bureau has found even more unspent funds in its coffers, at least $15 million. Now, City Council will decide how to spend it and if they should investigate how the money was missed. It's actually the second multi-million dollar sum that Council didn't know about. $21 million more dollars were revealed late last year. The money came from the transient lodging tax, paid by hotels and booking agents, and short-term rental fees from places like Airbnb. Counselors from District 1 put forward a plan to spend the extra money on programs to keep people from becoming homeless, things like rental assistance. Other counselors wanted some of the funds to go towards a cash-strapped affordable housing development. Now they could likely fund both. But the question of how the money went undisclosed to council is a thornier question. The first $21 million was revealed the day after the council had its budget reconciliation in November, having to close an $18 million gap. The head of the Housing Bureau was fired, but according to a memo she sent to the council, she was the one who discovered the money and was told not to go public with the information because it would look bad. City Council will also consider a resolution to investigate the city administration over the now $36 million in extra funds in the Housing Bureau. They plan to meet on these agenda items on Thursday at 2 o'clock p.m. As a partial government shutdown over DHS funding drags on, advocates say the standoff is not just about budgets, but about human dignity and who is recognized as fully human in the United States. As lawmakers debate a temporary funding bill, advocacy groups are mobilizing amid growing fear of ICE enforcement, launching nationwide efforts to defend constitutional rights. Judith Ruiz Branch has more.
As the government remains partially shut down over funding for the Department of Homeland Security, some Midwest advocates argue the moment is far greater than a budget battle, but rather a fight for human dignity. Democrats' demands for reforms to ICE operations reached ahead after federal agents shot and killed two U.S. citizens in Minneapolis last month. DeMario Cooper with grassroots organization Popular Democracy stresses that the current battle extends beyond immediate legislative outcomes to shaping the future of the nation.
Yes. This is a battle around this budget. We're in a moment of very intense battle, very important battle. However, the larger fight is really about who gets to be human in the United States in the future.
A two-week funding bill that would end the partial shutdown and temporarily aid DHS remains on the table. Meanwhile, advocates in Wisconsin say they've been preparing for a federal surge in immigration enforcement, similar to those witnessed in nearby Illinois and Minnesota. Cooper says even though his organization has recently seen increased volunteer participation, he acknowledges there is widespread fear, but he emphasizes that courage requires fear and that meaningful change has always required ordinary people taking extraordinary risks for foundational freedoms.
As ICE talks about going to different locations, we're receiving calls from our affiliates. People are scared. We are going to be scared, but we have to be courageous. We have to stand in our courage in order for us to create the type of society we want. It's always taking regular people being courageous for all the good things that have ever happened in this country. It's from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement.
Cooper says his organization champions equal rights under the Constitution. He says in addition to ongoing community response efforts, Popular Democracy will launch a campaign this week with nationwide affiliates to defend 14th Amendment rights and address Supreme Court cases questioning birthright citizenship.
We know that there are more of us who want to have a future that's a multiracial democracy, that our kids are able to go to school, that we're able to have health care and housing, that we have strong neighborhoods. There's more of us that want that than to take money from those things that do create safety and fund the president's personal police force.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
Customs and Border Patrol shot two undocumented Oregon residents outside a Portland hospital last month, claiming they were members of the Venezuelan Tren de Aragua gang. New reporting from The Guardian says that's not the case. Luis Nino Moncada drove the vehicle and was shot in the arm. He's still in custody, facing aggravated assault charges, with federal prosecutors saying he tried to hit agents with his car. Court documents from those prosecutors obtained by The Guardian contradict the narrative pushed by the Department of Homeland Security. They say he isn't a gang member. His passenger, Yorlenis Zambrano Contreras, was shot in the chest. DHS claimed she was involved in a Portland shooting the year before and was part of an international sex trafficking ring. An FBI affidavit shows she was actually reported as a victim of sexual assault and robbery in that shooting. Neither of the pair, who were dating, have any past criminal convictions. Portland City Councilor Samir Canal told The Guardian, quote, "The federal government cannot be trusted. Our default position should be skepticism and understanding they lie very regularly." End quote. Nino Moncada is still in custody, and Zambrano Contreras has pled guilty to misdemeanor improper entry into the U.S. On Wednesday morning, a federal court in Portland will hear arguments on a preliminary injunction to stop ICE from making warrantless arrests in Oregon. Innovation Law Lab is suing ICE on behalf of plaintiffs who were arrested without a warrant or probable cause. They're asking the court for a preliminary injunction, which would stop ICE from making these types of arrests. ICE is blocked from making these kinds of arrests already in Colorado and D.C. Earlier testimony in this case revealed ICE's practices and targeting of places like Woodburn. Woodburn is a majority Latino community. ICE used surveillance technology to identify what they called target-rich locations, trying to arrest at least 8 people a day. Those arrest quotas meant that they arrested people even if they didn't have any idea who they were before stopping them, as in, no criminal record. ICE also created warrants after people were already detained and refused to give them legal representation. The hearing is at 9:30 a.m. on Wednesday at the Hatfield Courthouse in Portland. Immigration enforcement is increasingly becoming a liability for Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Federal officials have been scouring sites across the country for potential places to hold immigrants as they roll out a $45 billion expansion of detention facilities to be financed by Trump's Big Beautiful Bill. The fatal shootings of Renee Good and Alex Preti during immigration enforcement actions in Minnesota have heightened concerns and led to increased scrutiny of those plans for new detention sites. A public hearing about a proposed ICE facility just north of Richmond, Virginia, drew hundreds of people last week. One resident said, quote, "You want what's happening in Minnesota to go down in our own backyard? Build that detention center here, and that's exactly what will happen." Legislatures in several Democratic-led states have moved forward with bills aimed at blocking or discouraging ICE facilities. A California proposal seeks to muscle companies running ICE facilities out of the state by imposing a 50% tax on their proceeds. In just over a year, the number of detention facilities used by ICE nearly doubled to 212 sites spread across 47 states and territories. Trump now appears to want to open more large-scale facilities. In January, ICE paid $102 million for a warehouse in Maryland, $84 million for one in Pennsylvania, and more than $70 million for another in Arizona. Federal immigration officials have been touring large warehouses without telling the public much about these efforts. State and local governments can refuse to lease detention space to ICE, but they generally cannot prohibit business and private landowners from using their property for federal immigration detention centers. In 2023, a federal court invalidated a California law barring private immigration detention facilities, ruling it infringed on federal powers. A similar ruling was handed down in New Jersey in July. Nationally, it remains to be seen whether local governments can effectively deter ICE facilities through building permits and regulations. Republicans warned of job losses and economic fallout if legislation forces immigrant detention centers to close. Texas' special election is seen as a wake-up call for the GOP. North Carolina students want a campus early voting site back. And Maryland Democrats debate redistricting ahead of finalizing midterm maps. With that story and more, it's Zamon Perez with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
You can either put your head in the sand as a Republican or as a MAGA loyalist and say, that's a one-off. And a lot of times I'm one of those people. This time, if you don't get the message, enjoy Speaker Hakeem Jeffries.
Sean Spicer, press secretary during Donald Trump's first term, is sounding the alarm for the GOP over a Texas special election. Democrats won a Fort Worth state Senate seat for the first time in decades after the district swung more than 30 points to the left. It's the latest in a series of off-year elections where the GOP underperformed, seemingly dragged down by affordability issues, increasingly unpopular immigration enforcement, and other issues. Trump endorsed the Republican, but distanced himself from the loss by saying it was because he wasn't on the ballot. North Carolina's largest historically black college was stripped of its early voting location for next month's primary. Election officials cited low voter turnout, but students at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University are backing a statewide lawsuit to get the poll location back. Shia Rozier with the student group Protect Ours says there's a clear pattern to what the state's 100 county election boards have done since being mostly taken over by Republicans.
When we look at the demographics in which they're targeting and that are consistently losing more access to polls, it's young students, it's minorities. So there's a commonality where it's really disenfranchisement of young and minority voters.
According to the New York Times, the director of national intelligence put FBI agents on the phone with Trump during a search of a Georgia election center last week. The presence of Tulsi Gabbard while agents confiscated hundreds of boxes of ballots itself raised eyebrows. Now the paper reports the president was speaking directly with officials at a site key to his false claims of election fraud. Maryland state lawmakers are debating a redistricting effort just ahead of the deadline to put the maps in place for the midterms. The legislature is divided, but supporters say another Democrat in Congress could fight for the tens of thousands of Maryland federal workers at risk since Trump returned to office. Isola Shaw is a former federal employee and a member of the Rockville City Council.
We want to make sure that we can use redistricting as a tool to protect our workforce and protect our communities and protect our families from the job losses from the Trump administration.
But Maryland Senate President Bill Ferguson argues Democrats are poised to win big in November, and redistricting could put the results there under a legal cloud. The House Rules Committee is set to consider a budget to end the government shutdown. The bill, which Trump has lobbied for, is expected to go to the floor for a vote this week. Democratic lawmakers have negotiated more regulations concerning the conduct of ICE agents. Technology giant Meta says it's pouring $65 million into super PACs to support candidates friendly to AI and the California tech industry. Federal AI legislation has stalled, putting the focus on state legislatures. California is also considering a tax on the ultra-wealthy, which is opposed by several tech billionaires. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 59. Today in history, in 2023, a freight train carrying hazardous materials derails and burns in East Palestine, Ohio, creating an environmental disaster. The quote of the day is from French philosopher Simone Weil, born this day in 1909. She wrote, quote, "Art is the symbol of the two noblest human efforts, to construct and to refrain from destruction." Ojibwe tribes object to Trump's plan to remove the roadless rule limiting road building on national forest land. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Ojibwe tribes in the Great Lakes region are raising concerns about Trump administration plans to remove a rule that limits road building in national forest land. Chuck Kornbach has more.
The roadless rule is a U.S. Forest Service policy that for 25 years has curtailed building or reconstructing roads in the national forests. There have also been limits on commercial timber harvesting in roadless areas that have been inventoried. Last summer, the U.S. Agriculture Department, which includes the Forest Service, proposed rescinding the roadless rule. The department said that would give more decision-making authority to regional forest managers and improve access for fighting fires. But the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, which serves 11 Ojibwe tribes in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan that have treaty-protected hunting, fishing, and gathering rights, backs the roadless rule. Commission spokesperson Jenny Van Sickle says agency scientists looked at how the rule has protected five national forests in what's called the ceded territory. She says the federal government has a responsibility to enforce treaty rights there.
That's wild rice. That's tapping maples for sap to make, you know, sugar. These are real activities. They're not theoretical. These are federal responsibilities that remain in place. So to try to kick that to regional foresters doesn't make a lot of sense.
Van Sickle says there are already many roads in the national forests. She says if the roadless rule needs amending, the tribes are willing to talk.
If the rule needs work, you know, we want to be at those tables. We want to talk about those problems. We want to get to those solutions, and we can do that together. We've worked very closely and formally with the Forest Service for nearly 30 years.
An Agriculture Department spokesperson says the agency remains committed to a consultation process with the tribes. Also, that if the roadless rule ends, land use decisions would still need to comply with specific forest or grassland management plans and other applicable laws, all developed with public involvement. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Tribal leaders respond to Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt's final State of the State address, which he delivered Monday. Tribal leaders say Stitt misrepresents tribes. Tribes and the governor have had a rocky relationship, including disagreements over jurisdiction, gaming, and other issues. In his speech, Stitt said all laws should apply equally to all Oklahomans. Stitt said, quote, "Many of us in this room have decried the DEI programs of the Biden administration, yet stand by quietly when someone says an Indian should be subject to a different set of laws." Choctaw Nation Chief Gary Batten in a statement said tribes and tribal members have sovereign rights, which are not based on race, but treaties and other agreements between tribal nations and the U.S. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. said in a statement that the governor effectively called for the termination of tribal government, calling it rhetoric cloaked in references to DEI and race. Hoskin said, fortunately, Stitt spoke to a bipartisan chamber. Both leaders say they look forward to working with the legislature and other elected officials. A number of tribal leaders attended the address. The Interior Department has added the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina to the official list of federally recognized tribes, formalizing the tribe's government-to-government relationship with the U.S. The agency published the updated list in the Federal Register following President Donald Trump's signing of legislation in December, granting federal recognition status to the Lumbee Tribe. The list consists of 575 American Indian and Alaska Native tribal entities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In 2025, Idaho was among the states to pass legislation that indirectly censors professors in higher education. A new report from PEN America looks at the trend of higher education censorship in legislatures across the country. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
Censorship is happening in higher education institutions across the nation, including Idaho, according to a new report. PEN America's analysis looks at state legislatures that succeeded in banning certain kinds of speech in the classroom. One of the laws explored in the report is Idaho's Senate Bill 1198, passed last April, which bans DEI offices on college campuses and prohibits colleges from requiring a course that is derived from or promotes critical race theory or DEI. Amy Reed with PEN America explains this law was categorized as an indirect form of censorship because it doesn't explicitly stop discussion, but rather puts up guardrails that are likely to make faculty wary of certain topics in their classrooms.
Indirect censorship is censorship, whether we're talking about a DEI ban or a curricular control measure or an attack on a faculty senate. Each of these things results in censorship, and our students nationwide deserve better than that.
Supporters of the law believe DEI and critical race theory are used to indoctrinate students. The PEN America report says 93 bills were introduced to censor higher education in 32 states. 21 of the bills became law in 15 states. The effort to limit topics discussed at colleges has intensified under the Trump administration. Reed claims the crackdown on free speech in college classrooms mirrors the anti-communist McCarthyism of the 1950s.
We at PEN America want to ensure that when students go away to college, they are given the freedom and the responsibility of engaging with ideas and making up their minds. We don't want someone else censoring the material and making their minds up for them.
The PEN America report says more attacks on higher education are expected to continue in 2026. That includes the possibility of U.S. Supreme Court involvement over the question of whether the speech of faculty at public universities is protected under the First Amendment. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Declaration of Independence proposes the right and duty of the people to alter or abolish a government that has failed its people and undermined the rule of law. As one observer notes, an updated declaration today would make the case for mass nonviolent resistance against a lawless, corrupt Trump administration. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Our Declaration of Independence is a living document. It has inspired resistance to oppression and movements for self-determination worldwide. Now I think that historic document has come full circle. It can and must inspire us once again as the American experiment confronts the greatest threat since the Civil War. Here, then, is my conception of a second American Declaration. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary to decide that a government that purports to represent the union of states has failed to do so, that the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness have been trampled upon by that government, and that the rule of law and the Constitution have been systematically violated. Then, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. Thus, we the people have determined that the present government under President Donald J. Trump is bent on the destruction of democratic authority and its replacement by an authoritarian regime that does not respect the Constitution, the rule of law, or the fundamental human rights of American citizens and other lawful residents of these United States. We therefore declare that the present government is illegitimate. Its president has violated his oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution, instead claiming absolute power. He has unlawfully and dishonorably ordered the prosecution of critics, abusing the independent role of the Department of Justice. He has appointed people to high government positions based entirely on loyalty to him, and with limited or no competence for the office to which they have been appointed. He has undermined the independence of various government agencies and institutes established by Congress, dismantling some and seeking to turn others into arms of the executive branch. He has denied critical funds to state and local governments that resist his administration's unlawful policies and regulations. He has shown contempt for Congress, ignoring its constitutional role in budgeting, war powers, and appointment of officials. He has not only continued to deny the legitimacy of the 2020 election, but also sought to undermine future elections with all manner of restrictions on voting. He has brazenly attacked the integrity of judges with whose decisions he disagreed. He and members of his cabinet have engaged in numerous corrupt dealings with foreign governments that enrich the president and his friends. He and his administration have systematically undermined civil society, including freedom of the press and freedom of speech in universities and law firms. His administration, turning the Department of Homeland Security into a domestic security tool, has illegally carried out military operations in the states and cities of these United States, operations that provoke violence and deprive Americans and lawful residents of their basic rights. His administration has undermined the purposes and creed of the professional military, removing senior officers without cause and committing U.S. military forces to illegal acts on the high seas. His administration has undermined the reputation of the United States, carrying out policies that are lawless and imperialist in the eyes of many governments and peoples around the world. He and his administration have ignored and denigrated the nation's science community, dismantling environmental regulations and research programs in defiance of the scientific consensus on global warming. And he and his administration have undermined traditional alliances with democracies, weaponizing tariffs to overcome their resistance to his policies and interfering in their internal politics by promoting the agenda of far-right political parties. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. We vow to use peaceful means and democratic processes to do so, answering force with force only as a last resort, confident that history has shown that mass nonviolent resistance has proven successful at overcoming oppression. For the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, February 3rd, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertow and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Isabel Charlet, Judith Ruiz Branch, Antonia Gonzalez, and Simone Perez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. One of my favorite parts of doing this show is getting to interview local authors. I am just in awe of the combination of skill, dedication, passion, and creativity required to write an entire book. And those traits are on full display in the new book, Born of Fire and Rain, Journey into a Pacific Coastal Forest, by Oregon author M.L. Herring. Born of Fire and Rain is one of the best books I've ever read on our bioregion. It is a masterfully guided hike through virtually every aspect of the Pacific coastal rainforest, seamlessly weaving in geology, ecology, timber politics, personal narratives, and a lot more into this really beautiful tapestry of this place we call home. ML is the pen name of Oregon State University Professor Emerita Peg Herring, and I am so delighted to have her on the show today. Before we get started, I have to give my usual housekeeping. Coast Range Radio is free on all podcast apps, which is a great way to share this episode with a friend or two. And the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Reach out anytime with thoughts or show ideas. Okay, Peg Herring, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thank you, Michael. I'm happy to be here.
I am so happy to have you on and talk about Born of Fire and Rain. And before we dive in, I was hoping you could give us a short reading from the book